Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is August 15th. Today's session is entitled Creating a Conscience, Raising Ethical Children in Today's World, Part 2, presented by Hallie Florine. Let's listen in.
I'm going to just go forward here. We talked about parenting time and how to gain some parenting time, such as having a family custom of eating dinner together every evening. We talked about parents really being clear about what their values are and their belief system is, and communicating that to a child. You know, talking about why they go to church on Sunday, why they like to help out a sick neighbor, why they don't steal from a store. And then we were talking about lack of structure and consequences, with permissiveness, letting the kid be the boss, negotiating all decisions. And the last, I think this is where we stopped, isn't it? Where we were talking about protecting from consequences and how really troublesome that can be. I remember a friend telling me a story that his son had. A son came and asked him if the dad was going to the store. He was going to the grocery store to pick up some items for dinner. And so the son went up to his dad and said, "Can I come along? I just need to pick up a couple of things at the store." And dad said, "Sure, come on, keep me company." So they drove to the store, and it was in a little shopping mall. And so the son said, they went and bought the items, and as they were coming out, the grocery items, as they were coming out, the son said, "Can I run over there to this other store to get those things I need?" And he said, "No, Mom is fixing dinner. She's waiting for these things. We have to get right home." And the kids started whining and getting upset and pleading with the dad. And finally, the dad said, "Well, what do you need that stuff for?" And the kid said, "For my science project." And the dad said, "When is it due?" And you know the answer. Tomorrow. Mm-hmm. And this man told me that was the hardest drive home he had ever made, because he didn't jump in there and rescue him. He said, "We don't have time, we're going home." And he had to take the consequences of that. Mm-hmm. And by doing that, he started really planning ahead for his next project. So sometimes parenting may mean making a kid unhappy sometimes, but if it's teaching a greater lesson, I think it's important. And I think that this is a particular problem nowadays. I think parents are really focused on their kids being happy, and think that anything that would cause their child unhappiness is obviously wrong. But I think that it's also associated with the fact that there are young adults going to college that need parental assistance still, because they don't take responsibility for themselves. And another mistake is where people, I used to see this at the airport a lot, where parents would be sitting there waiting for a plane and their kids would be running around, and the parents would call out instructions like, "Don't climb up on that. Come over here. Come back and sit down." But there was never any follow-through. They'd just call again. And it drives me crazy when I hear parents doing that. Because what does that train a child to do?
Ignore
the parent. And so that the child learns that they only need to answer after the parent has gotten to a certain level of yelling. You know, then they know, oops. And there was a study done to look at, you know, parents that keep repeating threats. The kids generally know exactly how many threats they have before the parent follows through. They know that. So parents that threaten tend to have kids that, without following through, that are not going to respect what the parent says. There's also, you know, nowadays, the average child has a VCR, a radio, a tape player, a CD player, video games, a TV in their room, and a computer. So if you say, go to your room, that's what we call sting-free discipline. You know, oh, sure. You know, I'll go in, watch a DVD, I'll go in, you know, talk to my friends on the internet, you know, all of those kinds of things. Discipline has to mean something for it to be appropriate. Now, remember I talked about Clark Dawson and Greta Hoft yesterday, the Minnesota researchers. And I like this quote where they say, structure is the bones of child rearing. Nurture cushions the bones. So even though a parent may provide good structure, nurture is just as important. You know, so we're not talking about a stern, iron-willed disciplinarian. We're talking about a loving form of structure. Where the child is comfortable in the fact that their parents love them unconditionally, even though they may not like what they do. You know, a lot of parents that I've worked with over the years have really disliked it when I talk about structure. You know, they may have grown up like, you know, in the 70s when it was, you know, freewheeling and discipline was frowned on. There were open classrooms where, you know, kids just did what they were interested in. But one thing I like to tell parents is about comparing discipline to sports. You know, as sports, there are rules. And there's a referee that enforces the rules. And if you didn't have the rules, you wouldn't have a game. You know, that the rules are what makes a game. And so in the home, in order to have something that's solid and of consequence, you need structure. You need that. And I like to use the word discipline. If people understand what it means. It's discipline, sometimes people think of a switch or, you know, spanking or something. But actually discipline comes from a Latin word called disciplina, which means to educate or to teach. And so discipline is about teaching children. And it's teaching them about decision making. And the more we can talk to children about making choices, the better. You know, the more they understand that consequences come from the choices they make, the more skilled they'll be as adults. I always have to put something from The Wizard of Oz in every slideshow I do because my niece loves The Wicked Witch of the West. That's her favorite movie character. But anyhow, punishment versus discipline. You know, with punishment, there really is that feeling of anger, you know, that when a parent is spanks a child, generally they're angry, you know. People sometimes will ask me how I feel about spanking. And I'll say, well, you know, I think with younger children, sometimes it's useful as long as it's done without anger. And then I've had parents come back with, but I don't want to spank unless I'm angry. And that's really key to understanding, is that if you are disciplining a child while you're angry, it probably means you're punishing the child. Because there is kind of this feeling of retribution, a kind of a nastiness about punishment. And the other thing is, any of you that have studied, you know, the behavioral sciences know that punishment is an ineffective way of teaching. That what happens is kids' behavior goes underground. If a kid gets his mom yelling at him when he does something negative, he'll learn to be more sneaky next time. He won't get caught. And so it's better to have discipline that's more like a traffic cop. You know, if you get a ticket, the person that gives you the ticket doesn't come and yell at you and say you're a bad person, and you know, they just hand you a ticket. And that's how discipline should be. This is what you did, and these are the consequences, as we both know. You know, so I wanted to make that differentiation because I think it's very important. A lot of people think that being strict means being very stern and angry. Well, and one important point I want to make is a parent doesn't need to decide right away what a consequence should be if it's a new situation, you know, if they haven't established it beforehand. You know, I've had a lot of parents say, I don't know what a good consequence is, and so I just say, take a time out because I don't know anything else to do. And I said, you can always take your time. You know, one good thing to do, and it's actually good role modeling, is to say to a child, you know, I'm feeling really irritated because of what you did. So I need a timeout, and I think you need a timeout so we can calm down. And when we're calm, you know, let's take 10 minutes, and when we're calm, we'll come back and talk about it. And in that 10 minutes, the parent can be thinking about what would be a good consequence, what would teach the best lesson in this situation. I think it's just fine if a parent says, wait till mom or dad gets home. I think as long as they say it, you know, this is an important issue, and I really want to discuss it with dad before I make up my mind. And then it isn't like dad is more stern, you know, so he's really going to get you if you come home. But it's more that we want to make a considered decision, and so we're going to wait till dad comes home. And it has the added bonus of the child waiting, you know, and wondering what the consequence is going to be. And usually the kid will think the consequence is going to be something 30 times worse than what it actually turns out to be during that time. And again, I want to emphasize, be handled as a choice. Saying to a child, I'm sorry you chose to do this. But as you recall, we talked about this and we said this would be the consequence if you did. And be proportional. I've worked with very angry parents. Usually people don't come to see someone like me about their kids until they're really angry at their kids. And so what they want me to say is, you should ground them for 3 months, or you should, you know, you should really get strict with them and not let them do anything. You know, they're yearning for me to say it's the kid that's bad. And so for parents that are really frustrated and angry, they need to remember to be proportional. You know, if a kid does something that's minor, then the discipline should in general be something minor. And as often as you can, and I think another thing is that's good is to be specific. Because some parents, you've been bad. You need to go to your room. Well, what does bad mean? It's really kind of a pejorative term that doesn't teach the kid anything. So you might say, you said you did your homework and you actually hadn't. And I'm feeling irritated about that. Now, let's talk about what we need to do about that. So that, and the more it can be cause and effect, the better. Well, you lied to me about your homework last night. Now, I think for the next 3 weeks, I need to check your homework each night. Or 2 weeks, or whatever the thing is, so that it represents cause and effect, and is educational. Now, if people are feeling I'm talking about too much negative stuff, I just wanted to talk about the negative consequence side of things, because so many people get it mixed up with punishment. That I want to be sure I share that. But in any parenting, there should be more positive affirmation than there is negative feedback. That the balance, it should be much more in favor of positive feedback. And in fact, what I usually tell parents when their kid has been out of control and they've been really angry at the kid, is that they need to begin noticing what the kid is doing right and commenting on it. They don't have to gush or anything, but just say, oh, you look nice today, I like that outfit. Begin noticing the things that are positive and kind of work towards getting more of a balance so that you are catching your child being successful. I want to say a few words about that. I'm not a big fan of paying kids or giving big gifts or anything like that. I think when parents and their children have good relationships, just the parent making a comment is enough. Have you found that? That just saying, great job, can mean just as much to a kid as saying, here's $10, go spend it on whatever you want. That a smile or a compliment is what you want to be able to give to a child, and that generally happens when you have a good relationship. But also you want to teach something. First of all, I think the best thing that parents can do is notice. That was the one promise I made to myself before I had a child, is that I would notice and comment on the positive things my child did. And it didn't mean complimenting my child necessarily, but sometimes it did. But it would be just noticing and commenting on it. Like if Tim and I were having a conversation, I'd say, you're really good company. I enjoy being with you. That kind of comment, I think, does more than anything else a parent can do. Another good thing is to ask how they feel about something. You wash the dishes and they look sparkly and clean. How do you feel about it? Because you want to train the child to compliment themselves. You want the child to be able to internalize and say, hey, I did a good job. So by asking them how they feel about something, you're teaching them how to assess their own behavior. This is what I was saying. You want things to become intrinsically rewarding. How many of you like to learn? Yeah. Yeah, you wouldn't be here if you didn't. I like to learn. I just really enjoy the process of learning. Now, I'm not sure exactly how my parents taught me that, but somehow I learned that learning was intrinsically rewarding. So I don't need to be paid to learn. I don't need to be complimented to learn. I do it for its own intrinsic value. And that's what we hope for kids, that they enjoy things for their intrinsic value as opposed to for the compliments they get. I just wanted to make a few comments about grandparenting, and then other people can comment if they want. You know, I think being a grandparent is a wonderful thing. And I think that grandparents have deserved the right to enjoy their grandchildren. But not if it undermines rules. For example, this one mother told me that she had a terrible time at Christmas because they were trying to teach their children to be less materialistic. But the grandparents always sent these huge, lavish gifts and said, we have a right to do that. We're the grandparents. And I don't know how hard she discussed it with her parents or what, but I think that if it's something that is undermining the parent value system, then the grandparents should really cooperate with that. But I think that a child, a grandchild, when they're visiting their grandparents, needs to follow the house rules. You know, maybe they're able to, you know, leave big messes or, you know, run around yelling, or they call their parents' names at their house. But at the grandparents' house, if that's offensive to them, they can say, in our house, we don't do that. In our house, we talk in a lower tone than that. In our house, we put things away. You know, and I think it's fine to do that. And I think it's also fine if the parents are there and the kids are not following the house rules for the grandparent to say, you know, I don't welcome this in my home. I think it's time for Johnny to go home. You know, I also think, and this is so hard, but advice giving is not appreciated. You know, and generally, if a grandparent gives advice that is not requested, it will probably be ignored. So the more you try to push your opinion on a parent, on your child, probably the more they'll buck against it. And so I talk about planting seeds, you know, just making comments that may not have anything to do with their parenting, but might be telling a story from their childhood, as long as it's not completely adjacent to a point you're trying to make, you know, so it's not. But sharing little stories where you are planting seeds, but you're not pushing. You're just hoping they'll take root. And then I also recommend that grandparents focus on the skills that their children are showing as parents rather than their faults or their mistakes. You know, I just was so pleased with the way you handled that. That was great. You know, so that the children are more likely to come to the grandparent, the parent is more likely to come to the grandparent and say, what's your advice about this? Because they see the grandparent as being basically supportive and not an adversary. So those are just a couple things I wanted to put in and by request. Did anybody have comments about this or thoughts? Okay. I want to talk about too much help. You know, there's so much competition nowadays to get into name schools or you know, that a lot of parents feel it's justified to give their kids a lot of assistance. You know, I had some parent, one parent tell me that her kids, and I'm blocking on the word for this, but they make these kind of cars, like go-karts. Yeah, go-karts. And the parents can help with the mechanism of the go-kart, but the kid is supposed to do the body. And in this particular town where I was, the woman told me that nobody follows that rule, except them. They tell their kids they have to do it themselves. And of course, they never win prizes because the other parents help them do these polished, beautiful, you know, sophisticated cars, while her children's cars look like they made them, you know, themselves. So I want to talk about that just a bit. I love this quote. When parents are over-functioning, children respond by under-functioning. So the more the parent is, you know, in there trying to help, the less the child will do. And some kids learn how to be incompetent because they learned if they act incompetent, their parent will rescue them. And, I've done it. I'm good at finding things. My son isn't good at finding things. But I think I taught him to not try very hard because I would always go and help him find things right away rather than saying, it's your problem. You know, you go find it. And kids tend to be pretty low motivation if their parents are always letting them out of scrapes or coming in and rescuing them. And the question that is often asked is, how much help should I give my child? And of course, it's age-related. You know, with an infant, you give them all the help you can. But a 16-year-old, probably not a lot of help. Children need to struggle. That's how they gain competence. So you need them to give them just as much help so that they have to struggle some, because that's going to make them grow. And this quote, young Samuel watched fascinated by a butterfly's struggle to get out. With the intent of being helpful, the boy cut away the chrysalis. But to his dismay, Samuel's butterfly, released from its struggle, couldn't fly. The butterfly needs to struggle to get strong enough to be able to fly. And I think that's a good image for parents to have. The struggle is so important. Another good thing that to do, I'm going to share a story of something I did that's right. Because it happens so rarely. But teaching kids skills of problem solving is so much better than, you know, helping them directly. One time, and Tim told me this story, and unfortunately I don't remember the incident, but I believe it happened because he told me. But we were out having lunch not that long ago when I was first giving this workshop, and I was telling him about it, and I was talking about problem solving, and he said, remember what you did when I was in fifth grade? I think it was fifth grade. And I said, no, what did I do? And he said, well, I was really upset because we had a state report due. I think that's in fifth grade. They often have to do a state report. And it had all these different parts, you know, like 10 or 12 different parts. And he said, how am I ever going to get this done? I'm never going to get it done. And so apparently what I did is I got down the calendar. And he said, I said to him, I want you to think of what you can do in about an hour, what part you can do in about an hour. And then I want us to write it on the calendar, what you're going to do each day, so that you'll be done by the time the report is due. And wasn't that clever of me? And anyway, he said, and look, Mom, I still do it. And he opened up his schedule, and he had written, you know, all the things he was going to be doing during the week. And, it just makes me happy. I'm not a sports fan, unfortunately, but I really think that being part of sports is a good thing because it teaches teamwork and reciprocity. But it can also be an orchestra. I played in an orchestra, and certainly that teaches teamwork. I was part of plays, and that certainly teaches teamwork. I think anything that can teach children about reciprocity and teamwork is very important, because some kids are growing up these days so narcissistic that they don't know how to cooperate. They think that they should always be the star, or they should not have to work too hard. And teamwork teaches you have to put in your part. And I mentioned this yesterday, but another Minnesotan, Marty Rossman, at the University of Minnesota, did a study where he was looking at all kinds of factors in childhood, like parents' parental theories, the sex of the child, all sorts of things, just a whole list of things, and then compared it to their success as young adults. And he measured success in a number of ways, not only having a good job, but also having a good social network and, you know, taking care of money responsibly and things like that. And they found that the most important thing about a kid's childhood that would relate to their success was whether they had started chores by the age of 3 or 4. Now, we're not talking vacuuming or the house or mowing the lawn at three or four, but certainly a child can help their mom dust or put the silverware around the table. And do kids that age like to do that? They're thrilled.
Sure.
Helping mommy or daddy, that is fabulous. And by doing it at that age, by the time they get to be 12 and 13 and are getting more obnoxious, they have already learned that. They've already learned that they need to help to be part of the family. Now, should kids be paid for chores? What do you think?
No.
No? No. I agree with you. I mean, there's a number of points of view, but what I will say to parents is, you know, you go to work and you get paid. But when you come home, you make dinner, you clean up, you vacuum, you do other things. No one's paying you to do that. That's part of being a part of the family. And what children need to learn is there's certain things you do to be part of the family. They compared the young adult success with kids that were started on chores at age 15 or 16. And the success was much lower than kids that were started early.
Could I make a comment or ask a question?
Sure.
The comment is that I think that one of the issues in modern parenting is that the switch from rural to urban life has diminished the absolute necessity of children doing chores that are absolutely essential to be done.
Right.
The four-year-old doesn't set the table, it will still get set. If the dishes aren't done, they'll probably still get done, as much as I would encourage children to do that. The question has to do with paying for work. I don't necessarily agree with that, but I do like the concept of giving children an allowance.
Yeah, we're going to talk about that.
So we can talk
a little bit about the issues with the allowance. Yeah.
The comment I was going to make was growing up, I don't know, you were going to mention the different type of toys people would receive, but growing up as a real young child, my father was in construction, so they ended up giving us toys that were trucks and dump trucks and toys that were work toys.
I think it's great when parents also give kids the real thing to play with. Not dumb trucks.
But
they have these Play-Doh stoves. But what happened to making cookies? I mean, you know, really making cookies. But I agree with you completely. And I also agree with that point about the family had to work together to succeed in farming days. But I talk to so many parents that say, but it's so much harder to have them do it. I can do it so much faster. And the fact is, that's part of parenting. I don't care if it's faster if you do it. It's part of parenting to have to have.
But it's a natural trap to fall into, I think.
Pardon?
It's a natural trap to fall into, because parenting takes work, and if you're tired after a long day.
Especially nowadays.
Yeah.
When we work harder than we've ever worked. I mean, you know, I believe you, I was working full time the whole time I raised my son, so I know how it feels at the end of the day. The other thing too is it teaches reciprocity, and I think it's perfectly makes sense for if a child refuses to contribute to the family, the parent refuses to contribute to something the child wants. You know, if the kid is saying, I'm not going to do the dishes, you know, I'm going to my room, I got work to do, or I got something to do. The parent can say, well, I'm not going to drive you to Billings tonight because I have something to do. You know, I think that's fine for the, because they need to realize that that everybody has to contribute, but often parents give a lot extra. And if they're not contributing, then the parent doesn't need to contribute extra. The sound is... The other thing that I think is being lost in our modern world is perseverance. You know, we live in this instant culture where, you know, learn to play the piano in 3 days. You know, so many kids haven't learned how to persist in something for a long time. And I think it's great for parents to say, you know, you can try out different things, particularly when you're younger. You know, I think it's great for kids to try out different things. But I want you to stick with something. I want you to stick with it for a long time. And because that teaches kids the lesson that if you persevere, you can do something very well. You know, I sometimes was mad at my parents because they made me practice piano. You know, I don't know if anybody else had that experience.
I relate to that.
Yeah. And I hadn't the choice. You know, I would recommend giving the kid a choice about whether they studied piano. But if they choose to study piano, then they should choose to practice. And I will always be grateful to my parents that they taught me persistence. You know, there were times that I hated the piano, but there were times when I just was in love with the piano. And I wouldn't have gotten there if I hadn't gotten beyond those early stages of really playing badly. Now, I did give up on the violin because I did play it really badly and I never got beyond that. Yeah, I like that picture. You know, you go into some kid's room and there is so much stuff in there you can hardly believe it. I mean, there, some kids just pay out absolutely everything they want. And I'm probably preaching to the choir here because most people that come to Holden are not big materialists, you know. I think kids need to understand the difference between wants and needs. An example is a child is due for some new shoes, and the child says, "I want this pair of Nikes that costs $150. I don't know how much Nikes are costing nowadays, but there are some that are well over $100. The parent, it would make more sense to say, you know, I budgeted $60 for a new pair of shoes for you. Now, I'm more than happy to buy you the Nikes. I'll put in that $60 and then if you want to earn the rest of the money, that's just fine. I know Mrs. Smith across the street needs a babysitter, and I know Mr. Jones needs his walk shoveled, and I'll put a list of extra chores on the refrigerator, and with dollar amounts. And once you've gotten together the $60, we'll go ahead and buy the shoes. What you've taught the child is they need shoes. They don't need $120, $150 shoes. Jean Clark of that group we've talked so much about has the test of four sort of guidelines for parents for when they buy their kids. And the first is, does this keep the child from learning developmental tasks? You know, I'm trying to think of a good example of this. Well, sometimes I think some kids don't learn math well enough because they have started using a calculator too early and don't really understand the concepts. That would be an example of kid not learning a developmental task. Anything that would keep a child from taking responsibility or learning a new skill, I think is kind of a negative. That's why I really, if at all, I'm not a big fan of kits for things, although my son did use kits, but I think it's so great when kids learn how to make things themselves without having them all pre-programmed. You know, I loved paper dolls when I was growing up. I don't know if they use. I think they're out of date. But we used to make our own paper dolls, you know, and would spend many happy hours making paper dolls. And now they have computer programs where you can design your own wardrobe online, you know. And all of that drawing that I did as a child has been really, I'm an artist, and it was really helpful for me in becoming a good artist. Is a disproportionate amount of family resources used for this? Do the kids dress well, but the parents shop at,
Goodwill?
Goodwill. I shop at Goodwill, but I choose to. You know, if all the money is going to the kids, that's not teaching the kids a good lesson. It's teaching the kids that the parents really don't need anything, that the kids are more important. And so you want to have things be proportional. So if mom needs a new pair of shoes, but Sally wants an expensive pair of shoes, it would be better to have her get a more inexpensive pair of shoes and mom get her pair of shoes as well. Is this doing harm? I think sometimes buying kids things they want is actually doing them harm, because it's saying, if I want something, I'm supposed to have it. You know, just because I want it, I'm supposed to have it. And is this meeting the parents' needs rather than the child's? I'm going to tell you a story where I wasn't being a good parent. Okay. My son grew up when Michael Jackson was famous in a good way, you know. They came out with a jacket. Some of you may have seen it. It was a red pseudo-leather jacket with all these zippers all over it. And Tim wanted it so much. And my son is a very persistent kid. And it's been really helpful for him in his life. But at that time, you know, every time he'd think of it, he'd say, oh, that jacket would be so great. Well, he didn't need a new jacket. But the more I thought about it, I thought about how fun it would be to surprise him with the jacket. And I did. And he never wore it. Never. Because he was too embarrassed. I mean, it was really flashy in it, you know. And that taught me a wonderful lesson that it was meeting my needs. You know, it feels good to give a kid something. And so if you're doing it just to make yourself feel better, that's not a good reason. okay. have such a remote control phobia, I tell you.
There you go.
Did it go? Okay. A saying of the Dalai Lama, remember that not getting what you want is sometimes a wonderful stroke of luck. I bet each one of us could think of a story where we wanted something really badly and didn't get it, and thank goodness, you know, that often we don't know what's best for us. and so keeping that in mind, so let's talk about allowances. I once had a woman in a workshop I gave who raised her hand and said that her husband was an accountant. And this is something only an accountant would do.
There's an accountant in the room, but
okay. Who's the accountant? Okay. When his kids were little, he gave them an allowance. He had them keep, at the level they could, records of how they spent it. I hear some parents having three jars, like put money for to save, for fun, and for others. You know, there's, you know, some simple system. And each year, he went over their books. At the end of the year, after he had audited them, he would give them a raise depending on how good they did at spending your money appropriately. And he and this woman was kind of making a joke about it, but she said, by the time the kids were in high school, they had control of all the money they needed. That they bought their own clothes, they bought their, you know, school books, everything, because they had become such good money managers. And, you know, I'm not an accountant and never could be. So, you know, I didn't do that well with this. But I think that the concept of giving kids a larger allowance because they demonstrate they can handle money is a really good concept. You know, if they show they can, they don't blow $5 a week on candy, but think about it wisely, then yeah, give them a raise. And make the allowance mean something. Some parents give allowances, but then they give the children everything they want anyway. So why have an allowance? I mean, I remember wanting a camera really badly and saving up my allowance and babysitting money to get the camera. I think that's such a valuable experience for a kid. And I think connecting expensive things with hard work is a good analogy to make. I've known a lot of young adults that think they should be able to carry Gucci purses and buy designer clothes and have a prestige car, even though they're working as a sales clerk in a drugstore. You know, they think that they're entitled to that. And I think an important connection is if you want a lot of stuff, you have to earn it. I'd rather work less and have not as much stuff, personally, but that's just me. Another thing is to teach kids how to shop. And one mother was telling me that when she would go like to Toys R Us and look at the, she would point out to them all the techniques the store used to get them to spend money. You know, when they walked in, you know how they often have these kind of displays of things they want to get rid of usually, or seasonal things. And she'd say, see this beautiful display? That's because they want us to buy these things. But that's not what we came here to buy. So we're just going to ignore it and would go around the store doing similar things, teaching them to be savvy consumers. Another thing that some parents told me is that at night when they were watching TV with their kids, they would tell what anxiety or need. They would figure out what anxiety or need the commercial created in order to make you want to buy the product they were advertising. So in other words, they were teaching the kids how to understand advertising, you know, because advertising is geared to make you uncomfortable so that you need this thing to make you better, you know. And so if kids start understanding that, they're going to be less subject to buying things on impulse. The sixth issue, does anybody, I have this very pretty watch that it's almost 20 up.
20 up.
Yeah, okay. We only have two. Constant happiness, the belief that kids need to be constantly happy, it is an issue. And I talked about this a little yesterday, so I won't. But children need in childhood to experience a full range of emotions so that they can learn how to handle those emotions from their parents. And if a kid is never disappointed, a kid is never has hurt feelings, a kid never gets angry because everything is solved for him, the kid will learn how to handle those emotions as adults. And in working with people in therapy, I think there's a lot of out-of-control anger out there right now. People that have not learned how to handle their anger because perhaps their parents rescued them, you know, from experiencing any anger by solving problems for them. But if parents can, use an instance when a child is angry and talk about it and say, you know, what the best question is, well, how do you want this to turn out? You're angry at your best friend. How do you want this to turn out? Well, not very many kids are going to say, I want that kid to hate me forever. You know, if the kid thinks about it, I want him to understand my point of view and be my friend. Then yelling at that friend is not a good approach for that kind of outcome. So that's handling emotions effectively. Delay of gratification. That's all self-control things that parents need to teach. That you can want something and say, okay, I want this car. I'm going to save up over the next 6 months or a year to be able to buy that. And I think teaching little tools, like this is one that some counselors teach in schools, when they're feeling out of control, to stop and freeze, take a moment, and think about the situation and the possible consequences. And then do something that will get the best consequence. You know, it's a lot of times they teach breathing along with that, because, you know, breathing, good, diaphragmatic breathing, you know, using your diaphragm to automatically controls a person when you learn that relaxed kind of breathing. They learn how to relax. I think it should also be taught in prisons. I like sound effects. There's many parents who think that it's their job to entertain their children. If you would have gone to your parents and said, I'm bored, what would your parents have said? Pardon?
So what?
So what?
Oh, me too.
They give you something to do. We go to work. Yeah. It was always long we cut them.
Yeah.
I taught confirmation instruction. This girl came to the class one day and she just looked really out of sorts. Says, how are you doing? She says, I hate this. This is so boring. And I said, well, whoever declared to you that you have the right to be perpetually entertained. One-upsmanship on a 12-year-old, not fair, I guess.
Yeah. Now, you know, there is always a saying, only boring people get bored.
Yeah.
You know, because actually, I think that when a child has boredom, I think they have a boredom spot. I found that picture and I like it, so. boredom is when kids get creative. You know, if they have nothing to do, they'll make something to do. And so I think it's good for kids to have open time and be bored. You know, my mother would have said to me, I know because she did, find something to do or I'll find you something to do. And I knew what that meant. And also, you know, children are too busy nowadays, I think. You know, they have too many lessons and clubs and sports, and kids are tired. I've talked to lots of kids that are exhausted because their parents want to make sure they have all these experiences. When a child needs time to daydream and to be creative and to think about things, that's all very important to a child growing up. And the last issue I want to talk about is too much emphasis on self-esteem. By that I mean, I really believe in helping children have good self-esteem, but I think the mistake is how kids get self-esteem. I don't think kids get much out of just compliments. I think what self-esteem comes from is a feeling of competence. You know, when you take the time and learn how to do something really well, I think your self-esteem rises. You know, I when I teach myself a new skill, I do a lot with beadwork and handwork, and if I get a book and I learn how to do something, I feel really good about it. Those are self-esteem builders, as opposed to somebody saying, that's a great thing you made. I feel better about learning to do it. I made this mistake sometimes where I was so dead set on never being too critical that I just saw the good things. I talked about noticing. I think that it's important to notice the good things, but you also shouldn't wear blinders. You know, I'm good at a lot of things and I'm bad at a lot of things, and that's true for all of us. And I think it's better for us to know what we're truly good at and know that we may need more help or we may need to work harder in certain areas, and that's okay. And glorification. Have you seen that? You know, my child is so talented. He could be a movie star. You know, where the parent is just focused on glorifying the child. And usually it's for the parent's own needs, isn't it? You know, if my child is, gifted and wonderful, and, you know, then I must be a gifted and wonderful parent. And so I think it's good for kids to know what their strengths are and their weaknesses. And learns to accept that other kids can be better at things than them. I've done therapy with so many kids that are perfectionists. They think if they can't be good at it, they shouldn't do it. I started taking ballroom dance lessons about 20 years ago, and I took lessons for 9 years because I'm a klutz. Now I can ballroom dance, but I'll never be great at it because that's not a skill. You know, talent of mine. I'm never going to be talented in that area. I can be competent, but I don't have that particular gift. And I think it's good for me to do something that I'm not good at. I got to tell you a little story real quick. I used to do a group therapy with adolescents, which was one of my very favorite things to do. But I had this one group I used to call my heavy metal group. It was a girls' group. And when they came in, they all had different costumes. You know, I think I had two goth kids, you know, kids and dressed in black with white makeup. And I had a gal who did the biker thing with leather and chains and everything. And there was this one gal who actually ended up going to the same college I did, came in one day with her hair loosed into spikes like the Statue of Liberty, and each spike was tipped with purple paint or purple dye or whatever they use, I don't know. And her mother was bringing her to the group, and I was coming out to get all the kids, and the mother said, "Isn't her hair cute?" And we got into the group room, and I sort of shrugged because I thought it looked terrible. But we got into the group, and as soon as the door was closed, this gal says, "My mom thinks it's adorable? Ick." You know, she wanted the mother to say, "That looks disgusting," or "That looks terrible," because, you know, she wanted to push back. And so if parents give reality feedback, the kid doesn't have to go so far to push back, you know. So I think it's perfectly okay to say to a kid, you know, "You came up with that outfit? Wow," you know, and give them feedback that allows them to know they're pushing back. I'm going to just run through these quick because, you know, some of this is repetitive, I think, emphasizing a child's superiority, you know, making a child always need to win. I think that we live in a world nowadays where we need to learn cooperation rather than winning. How many would agree with me about that? You know, I mean, our world is going to come to an end if we don't learn how to cooperate. And so I think it's very important for parents to teach respect for all. I was in an area where I had a woman say, I knew what she was talking about, but nothing was really said out loud. She said, "You mean even people that whose way of life you disapprove of, you would teach them respect?" And I said, yes. I think a person, just by virtue of being a person, it deserves respect. You know, and even if you disagree with them, even if you don't approve of their lifestyle, they still deserve respect. And teaching empathy and compassion. You can start teaching empathy when kids are 2 or 3 by saying, you know, if they're playing in the sandbox, "Oh, Tommy fell down. He hurt his knee. Oh, poor Tommy." And demonstrating to a child the need to feel what other people feel, which brings us kind of to full circle of what we talked about with attachment and attachment disorders. I think that there's a lot of kids nowadays that are not learning empathy. And children need to understand they are part of a community, not the center of the universe. There is, when I ask teachers what is the biggest issue they have in their classroom, a lot of them talk about the bullying. And not just the kind of physical bullying, but the mean girls kind of bullying. Remember, I talked about that movie yesterday, Mean Girls, where it's been called the most enduring and understated problems in American schools. I have a story about that, but I am going to let you go to supper rather than telling you my story. Yeah.
Thinking about some of those slides, probably the idea I was thinking of as you thumb through them or bring your through them is most of us have grown up with more than one sibling, but I've seen as growing up years, some of the families with only one child, and one child is the center of the whole family.
Yeah.
And I find that really different.
Yeah. Yeah. Some of the research doesn't hold that up as true. You know, sometimes people see only children as spoiled. The research doesn't hold up being spoiled, but I think they have difficulty with things like sharing or cooperating more than. And I think that if you're a parent of an only child, you really need to go the extra mile to make sure they have a lot of peer play and mm-hmm. situations where they learn to be with people. I agree about that completely. Yeah. One thing that I think can be most helpful to parents who decide they're not going to fall into our current culture of consumerism and greed and narcissism, but all of their kids' parents buy into it. Well, that's what I usually suggest is forming parenting groups where you get together with other parents that believe similar things to you. And maybe have big picnics where the kids come and play. But the parents are getting together and supporting one another and making the hard decisions. One person told me that their kid was upset because the other kids' parents were renting a limo for the junior high prom. And taking a stand about that, you know, saying that's inappropriate. If you have other parents that say, you're absolutely right, you know, I think it helps you make those hard decisions. So I really like the idea of parenting groups where you can give one another support.
Wouldn't that be particularly helpful in single parent families?
Oh, it would be great. It would be great because, I was a single parent. And a lot of times I make decisions, and luckily I have a wonderful sister and brother-in-law who I ran things by on a regular basis. It is a lonely thing. It's a lonely thing. I got this from a school principal. They had it written on a card. So we sow a thought and reap an act. We sow an act and reap a habit. We sow a habit and reap a character. We sow a character and reap a destiny. You know, I think it's a powerful reminder to parents how important their work is, because they are sowing a destiny by the little choices and decisions that they're making each day with their kids. So that's it. And I said two kids from the village at 10 Mile Falls. Any comments or questions before we go ahead? We're all tired. Yeah.
Probably the other comment I would think of is growing up, I was in fifth grade on Beacon Hill in Seattle, if they people know the area, In fifth grade, one of our family, one of my schoolmates, their father died, passed away, I guess would be a better way of saying it. But with my adopted parent, we sat down and talked about death and dying as children, and realizing that, eventually one of us my mother or my father will eventually die. So we were thinking and learning about death and dying at an early age.
That's a great point. And you know, one thing I didn't talk about it today, but you know, when kids have a goldfish as their first pet, and the goldfish, of course, sometime dies, so many parents will go and quickly get it out of the kid's room before the kid gets home from school and buy a new one that's as similar as possible. While they're giving up a wonderful opportunity to talk about death and dying and discuss the feelings that are normal for grief. You know, I think pets are another vehicle. Of course, you don't want pets to die. I'm a confirmed cat lover. But the death of a pet, you can teach so much so that if a parent does die or a sibling does die, that they have already been introduced to the concepts of grieving and realize that it's okay to grieve and that they didn't do anything wrong and all of those things that are so important for children to learn. That's just an excellent point. Yeah.
Thank you
so much.
Thank you.